Hello, everybody. This is David Rovics back with another episode of Discussions with David, which goes out to you several days a week at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. And it goes out on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, KBOO Community Radio here in Portland, Oregon, and various other platforms, including my YouTube and Twitter and Twitch and other places on the internet. And goes it turns into a podcast afterwards. If people look for This Week with David Rovics, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to davidrovics.com, you can find it all there too. And today, I'm very happy to be spending the hour with Joe Gerson from out in Massachusetts, who's with a new group as far as, well, I have to ask him about whether it's a new group or not, but the Campaign for Peace, Disarmament, and Common Security. And for a very long, many decades, he was an organizer with the American Friends Service Committee around issues involving nuclear weapons and imperialism and peace. And with no further ado, let me just bring on to the screen Joe Gerson. I used to have more of a script, but now I just improvise. So I'm like, okay, yeah, that's enough of an intro. Joe, it's great to have you.
Good to be with you.
It's usually the case with the people I'm talking to that I never know where to start because there's just way too much to talk about. Like there, I guess there usually is, but right now it's who knows? But I mean, they're miniaturizing nuclear weapons. We're leaving. The U.S. is leaving all kinds of treaties, and yet Trump was having meetings with North Korea. It's been a wild roller coaster the past few years in terms of like tens of thousands of troops being withdrawn from Germany. I mean, I know that generally most viewers would probably assume that most people would be saying we need to vote for Biden, get Trump out, and that there's all kinds of very reasonable arguments. But can you just like give us some kind of a little background here in terms of like what has been going on in the past few years in terms of the U.S. and U.S. imperialism and military bases, it's a lot of mixed messages, it seems to me. If you're really paying close attention, if you're a real news junkie, which I am, it's still really confusing.
It's really, in many ways, it is total chaos, and it's a reflection of Trump's very confused and self-worshipping way of approach to the world. At a deep level, Trump has been moving us into something like a tyranny. My take is that if he's reelected, we're going to be moving at a faster rate into a tyrannical system. It's a story today that he signed an executive order yesterday, which in the second administration would give him power to fire many thousands of civil servants, so able then to bend the government much more to his will.
Wow. That's fascinating that he did this executive order yesterday, because he could just as easily have waited until after the election to really kind of get this, what sounds like a process of rapid fascistization of the government. I mean, he could have waited till after the election, but he did it yesterday.
Look, the drive has been on for quite some time. So, the idea of waiting, this is an impetuous guy with a really disastrous vision. And, as we know, the people he identifies with are basically tyrants in other nations, the autocrats, whether it's Putin or he admires Kim Jong Il in North Korea because he's able to consolidate total power in a short period of time. It's interesting. I read Michael Cohen's book, which on the one hand makes you feel like you're diving into deep filth, but on the other hand, what you see there
This is Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen.
Yeah, right. What you see there is just the total corruption of this man, total disregard for any law. And as Cohen writes, his ambition is to, in a sense, emulate Putin, who Trump believes has been able to transform, to bring the entire Russian system, its economy, its politics, and all the rest, into his personal system. And this is what Trump clearly aspires to do. So we've had that. And in this context, you know, and you also have the issues of his obviously dependence and identification with Russian oligarchs. You know, what we know is the amount of money that's moved into his hotels, into the condos he sold, and the rest. So, you know, there's a deep, deep kind of relationship there. And Trump clearly, you know, his approach is antithetical to anything approaching Western democracy. So you have his alienation from Western European nations. At the same time, I mean, you know, there are contradictions here, right?
So, well, he's really appealing to a certain base in Western Europe, though. I mean, there's leaders like him in Western Europe who have, has a messianic. The same people that are into Le Pen and the AfD in Germany, right? They love Trump. Sure.
And you know, and in Poland, and Hungary as well. And you know, one of the things that you see in the kind of period of transformation that we've been in is an identification with the Christian right here in the United States, Christian white right, the kind of white Christian racism of Russia and sectors of Europe. So, you know, quite remarkable. I mean, Republicans were long so opposed to Russia. Anything Russian, you know, was
isn't terrible. Quite a transformation that he's managed to, like, that he hasn't completely alienated the leadership of his party, but has rather just, they're just going along with it. Whereas just a couple of years ago, it would have been, or a few years ago, it would have been hard to imagine.
Yeah, but what underlies it, I think, is a social identification
with authoritarianism,
white supremacist Christian culture, which is where. Yeah, Trump has ruled, you know, with control of the Orthodox Church there, and you know, kind of Russian Putin. Nationalism, and we have the same here. So you have the undermining of NATO, and you know, this is a mixed message here, right? I mean, the principal reason that we're in a new Cold War with Russia goes all the way back to Bill Clinton, and you know, we had at the end of the Cold War, the last days of the Cold War. You had this seminal agreement between Gorbachev, Baker, and the first Bush, in which the United States agreed to allow German reunification to move forward on the basis of West German society and dominance. You know, the Russians had long feared Russian unification, you know, given the histories of the First and Second World War, but. The exchange, the deal with the Russians got out of it was a commitment that the United States wouldn't move NATO an inch or a centimeter closer to Moscow. Well, Bill totally violated that. We now have NATO at Russia's borders. We have a German of all peoples, German troops on Russia's borders. We've got U.S. forces on Russia's borders. And the Russians, you know, given their history of invasion from the West and their sensitivity to it, and the losses they had in those two wars, you know, their response has been to build up their military, and we're now in an increasingly dangerous situation with Russia. And the other thing you see here, which really began under Obama, is the you know, so-called pivot to Asia, a recognition that. The global economy, the most dynamic dimensions of the global economy are in Asia Pacific and especially in China. The recognition that China increasingly poses a challenge to U.S. global hegemony. Not that the Chinese necessarily want to be the global hegemon, but certainly a regional hegemon.
And until Trump came to power, to remind people, the U.S. And other countries were working on this whole Asia, the TTIP and the TPP, which were explicitly designed to exclude China and Russia.
Right. The idea was to basically consolidate U.S. dominance of the Asia-Pacific economy with the TPP. And there was a similar process underway, as you mentioned, with the Europeans. But what we've seen is at the highest levels of government, not only Trump, a perception that the Middle East no longer plays the central geopolitical role that it did in the Cold War, that its fossil fuel supplies are no longer as critical to the U.S. economy as they were then, or even the U.S. war machine. And so you have a, and plus the history of 20 years of catastrophic wars there. So what you see is a downgrading of U.S. Military involvement and commitments to the Middle East, and the goal to build up the U.S. military forces to contain China. And while Trump has kind of eased up on U.S. military commitments in Europe and in the Middle East, Afghanistan, he's been building up in Asia Pacific. And we're in a situation where an incident, an accident, or miscalculation, we're in an area of intense conflict in the South China Sea, East China Sea, maybe over Taiwan, could easily spill into an escalating war, even a nuclear war. So it's interesting. In the last month, we've seen more sectors of the peace movement and conscientious people beginning to move as quickly as they can to understand these Asia-Pacific dynamics.
Right. And part of the dynamics is challenging wherever China is doing anything in the South China Sea and going around all over the place with the Navy, but also this whole new program of smaller nuclear weapons that they're mm-hmm. developing. I don't know how far back does the mini nuke program. I mean, I've been hearing about it for a long time, but never so much as in the past few years.
Sure. So, I mean, many nukes, certainly go back to the Eisenhower administration when the idea was that faced with a larger Russian conventional military and a smaller U.S. military and the need to invest in our economy, the idea back in the Eisenhower era was, we get challenged, we fight a nuclear war. And they planned both, backpack nuclear weapons and big strategic weapons that could wipe out a city. So they've come back, especially now under the Trump administration. And the idea is to call them, more useful battlefield nuclear weapons. They've been particularly focused on deployment in Europe, where you've both got increasingly submarine launch missiles that can deliver them, and now plans to upgrade the B-61-12 warheads, which are held in five European states. And interestingly, in Europe, the peace and disarmament movements there have been gearing up to oppose these new deployments. We're moving into a situation which in Europe is somewhat analogous to what we had in the 1980s. When Europe was increasingly at the center of the dangers of nuclear war, we had then the enormous protests in Europe that then spread to the United States. It led to the nuclear weapons freeze and the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Agreement and the end of the war. Well, also, the deployments.
The end of the Cold War. Yeah, I mean, you're talking about the Cold War. Like, can you talk a little more about that? Because I think a lot of people. I mean, especially, I don't know who, but a lot of people are really ignorant of this history, which is really important. I mean, in the media, in the mainstream media, which I think with a lot of people who are involved with all sorts of protest movements in my lifetime, whatever the protest movement it is that they're involved with, it's compared to the civil rights movement and to stuff that happened in the 60s. And the mainstream media tends to really ignore anything that happened since then. So I think even though a lot of people like my age might have grown up in the 80s, and I know about what you're talking about, but a lot of people are not aware that there were the really, really huge and sustained nonviolent mass protests across Europe and the United States in the 80s that had a real impact on policy. And I wonder, can you just talk about that? You were there as well.
I was there. This is old codger's history here. So what you had in the very late 70s was a severe escalation of the nuclear arms race. And to appreciate that back then, there were about 30,000 strategic nuclear weapons. I mean, it was ridiculous. I mean, some of the targets, you know, which were, you know, like bridges, had multiple strategic weapons, many times the size of the Hiroshima A-bomb targeted on them. But the idea at the time, the Russians were moving what were called the SS-20 missiles into Eastern Europe, and the United States was moving to deploy both cruise missiles and a thing called the Pershing missile, which would basically target the Soviet leadership and all their infrastructure, could wipe them out within 8 minutes. And so at a period when the Reagan administration came in, increasingly threatening the possibility of nuclear war, one of Reagan's senior advisors said quite publicly that we could defeat the Russians with enough shovels, which was to say, if people could dig their individual little holes to climb in, we could somehow win a nuclear war. So these dangers sparked initially protests in Europe, but it also came at the time of transition in the Soviet Union, when Gorbachev, who wanted to reform the Soviet system, came to power. He wanted to invest in economic development and recognized that to do so, he had to reduce spending for nuclear weapons and others. And in response then, particularly to the demonstrations in Europe, we began having demonstrations here in the United States. I'm just outside of Cambridge. I lived in Cambridge for a long time. There was a study group at MIT called the Boston Study Group. It was led by one of the former members of the Manhattan Project that developed the atomic bomb, and a number of PhD students looking at how they could try to stanch the arms race. And one of the students, a woman named Randall Forsberg, came up with a concept of halting the nuclear arms race, the idea of freezing the arms race where it was. It wouldn't be abolition, but it could halt it. An idea which was perceived in the United States as being ultimately very fair. And one of my, actually, a little bit of history here. Randy Keeler, who was the young man who inspired Dan Ellsberg to release the Pentagon Papers, which had, you know, the secret history of the Vietnam War. Randy and a woman named Frances Crowe from American Friends Service Committee in Western Massachusetts, they had the idea of taking the concept of the freeze to local referendums. And so in 1980, at the same time that Reagan was winning in some of those districts in Western Massachusetts, people voted overwhelmingly for the freeze. One of my colleagues, a guy named David McCauley in Vermont, had the idea of taking it to town meetings. I mean, the mythic foundation of American democracy. Mm. And he somewhat outrageously said that in 1981, 15 towns and cities in Vermont would vote for the freeze. And the next year that 175 would. And we all looked at David and said, beautiful idea, but no way it's going to happen.
Quite a prediction. Very specific numbers.
Yes. And actually that spring, late winter and spring, 17 towns in Vermont voted for it. And it led to an op-ed in the Times. And people now had a model they could work with. So in 1982, you had 330 towns in Massachusetts and cities voting for the freeze. 8 states voted in referendum for the freeze. Meanwhile, there have been all kinds of public actions, you know, human chains and, you know, civil disobedience and other things.
And some of the towns voting, I remember growing up in suburban Connecticut, there were towns around there that were voting for the freeze. It wasn't just like the progressive hotbeds and the college towns. It was all sorts of towns.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was a period of real fear, in a sense of fear that should be felt today. You know, people in suburbs, you know, were afraid that, you know, they and their kids were going to die.
But why is it, Joe? I mean, it seems like so many people since the end of the Cold War are not as afraid of nuclear nuclear conflict, and yet the people like you and many others who are knowledgeable about a lot of the details about what's going on are raising the alarm and saying people should be more afraid than ever. And it seems like a real disconnect to me.
It is, and maybe that's part of the value of this program, right? I mean, I can be self-critical that I have not come up with a formula like the freeze to kind of move things forward. But only just to complete that thought, out of those movements, you had a million people demonstrated in New York City, 1982, called for the freeze. That kind of pressure led Senator Kennedy, then Congressman Markey, to try to seize control of the movement and press it in Washington. It forced Reagan to do what he had sworn he would never do, which was to negotiate with Gorbachev and the Soviet Union. And meanwhile, you had in Europe, Olof Palme, who was then the prime minister of Sweden, was bringing together leading figures from Soviet Union, from Europe, from the United States, and they developed a concept of common security. The idea that you can't get security by increasing your arms. You can't get security against your opponent. You have to get security with your opponent. That led to the negotiation of the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Agreement, the commitment not to deploy those weapons I mentioned before, and really to the end of the Cold War in 1987, 2 years before the fall of the Berlin Wall. So I mean that's some of that history, and some of us are trying to draw on it now. And I will say that it's interesting. yesterday, I received an email from a Japanese journalist friend of mine saying that in the United Nations, well, that they were expecting the last three ratifications of a treaty called the Treaty for Prevention of Nuclear War to be registered with the UN today, which would then put that treaty into force. It doesn't do everything we want. I mean, the nuclear powers have stood outside of it. They're increasing their arms. But this means that more than 50 of the world's countries have come together, on the one hand, saying they will never have, possess, allow transportation of, and so on and so forth, of nuclear weapons in their countries. And it also requires them to press the countries that have nuclear weapons and their societies to work for a nuclear weapons-free world, which we're committed to by the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. So it's interesting. I mean, while we're kind of blind here and understandably obsessed with the outcome of the election on November 3rd, you have a really serious force going on outside, which is getting very little coverage in the mass media. And just to say that again, I don't remember, it must have been the day before yesterday, I was on a small Zoom meeting, which included the former Austrian disarmament ambassador, a man who's really moved this process forward in important ways, a man who was in many ways inspired by the A-bomb survivors and their terrible descriptions of what nuclear weapons do and the imperative, you know, that human beings and nuclear weapons can't coexist. And what he said was that what we really need right now are societal discussions, much as we had in the early 80s, meaning in the streets and everywhere else. And hopefully the TPNW can help us move in that direction.
I mean, how long was there really, or was there ever really a sort of a commonly held belief in the idea, and I guess what they called the doctrine of mutually assured destruction, that if anybody uses a nuke, then that's going to be the end of the world. I mean, in the 80s, that started changing with Reagan and his cabinet making references to surviving nuclear war, and with if we just survive, everything will be destroyed, but we can come out of our holes and rebuild society, and we'll call that a victory. I mean, that wasn't so much the case in the 70s and the 60s. I mean, was it? Although, I mean, you document in your book, in Empire and the Bomb, how every administration since Truman has threatened to use nuclear weapons at some point, right? So it's right. It's not like that never goes away, but there was for a long time more of an idea, like it was just a crazy idea, although we talk about it.
Yeah. So what you have, the concept of mutual assured destruction grew out of really in the late 60s when Russia achieved something like parity with the United States. So the idea was that in a nuclear war, there would be no winners. Society, civilization would be totally destroyed. Before that, there had been total U.S. nuclear superiority. And you've had in the U.S. elite this debate and struggle over whether so-called deterrence should be the U.S. policy, or whether we should achieve nuclear superiority and the at least the theoretical ability to launch a first strike nuclear attack, a disabling nuclear first strike attack against a potential enemy, and thus win a nuclear war. So, you know, with Reagan, the idea of Star Wars was the idea to create a shield, functionally, you know, the shield to protect the U.S. nuclear sword. So we could launch a first strike attack against Russia, Soviet Union, and then our missile defenses would be able to disable any surviving missiles that the Russians would send over back at us. And, you know, this, despite the really the insanity of this, funding, I mean, billions and billions of dollars for missile defenses have been spent now over the last 40 years. You know, the Democrats have tended, actually, U.S. doctrine, even through the Obama administration, has been first strike nuclear warfighting capability. Obama attempted to eliminate that and have simply a deterrence policy. And of course, should deterrence fail, we all die anyhow. But the Pentagon pushed back very hard, and Obama chose not to use his political capital to end that. So we've consistently had this first strike, and you had the deal, you know, the New START treaty, which looks like it'll be extended now for a year. When it was negotiated, and Obama needed the votes in the Senate to ratify the treaty, the Republicans demanded that the U.S. spend billions of dollars to build new nuclear weapons and to revitalize the delivery systems, the missiles to deliver and bombers to deliver them. The price tag for that has now moved to $1.7 trillion. I mean, it's a staggering sum.
For this kind of overall update of the systems?
Everything. I mean, the idea is you replace your bombers, you replace your nuclear submarines, you replace your ground launch missiles, you the whole system, and a whole new generation of nuclear warheads. I mean, it's basically building the U.S. nuclear arsenal for the 21st century.
This kind of like pushback between this kind of like conflict between Obama and military advisors and Republicans. I mean, is that something that has a lot of precedent in the past 50, 60 years, or is that particular to Obama? Or, I mean, I'm just wondering in terms of like the Democrats and the Republicans. I mean, when you look at the Vietnam War, of course, it was largely prosecuted by Democratic administrations, as well as, you know, Nixon and Johnson both, and, you know, as well as other wars in before and after that, there've been both parties very much involved. But I wonder, is it, how accurate is the sort of assumption among people that vote Democrat that the Republicans are more interested in attacking the rest of the world than the Democrats are?
I think by and large, that's true. But only by and large. You know, I mean, Kennedy, John Kennedy won the election claiming that there was a missile gap, that the Russians had more nuclear missiles and weapons than we did, only to find out on coming to power that we had overwhelming nuclear power at the time. And it was out of the Cuban Missile Crisis really sobered Kennedy. I mean, his advisors thought the odds that we would go to nuclear war were essentially 50-50. There's a new book now by Marty Sherwin, which begins by telling us just how close we came to an unintended nuclear war on October 27th, 1962. That sobered the United States, sobered Kennedy. And he then moved. I mean, one of the first things that he and Khrushchev did after that was to negotiate the ban on atmospheric nuclear testing. Not enough, but it was a step, and he was sobered. Kennedy also gave a major speech at American University in 1963, in the spring of 63, in which he was basically calling for an end to the Cold War and for diplomacy with the Soviet Union. And there are serious arguments that Kennedy may have intended to withdraw U.S. forces from Vietnam after the 64 election. And there is, you know, it can't be documented at this point, but there are serious arguments made that those two commitments were what led to Kennedy's assassination. So you have that. You know, Johnson actually threatened nuclear war during the Vietnam War, during the Khe Sanh siege. So a delightful Democrat there. Obama came to power as he gave this major speech in Prague, which raised the world's hopes. I mean, he called for a U.S. policy, you know, calling for to create a nuclear weapons-free world. But in the event, he was unwilling to take the political risks and spend the political capital to take us there. But he did try to move from the first strike doctrine, failed in doing it. Now with Trump, you have an absolute commitment to first strike doctrine. You have the effort to build a nuclear arsenal that can dominate, can be have nuclear supremacy. And this in turn has been sparking a nuclear arms race, not only with the Soviet Union, which is building new missiles and weapons, but now in China. I mean, the Chinese approach has been very different. I mean, we have about under the START treaty, we have 1,550 strategic nuclear weapons deployed. I mean, that's enough to bring on nuclear winter. Nuclear winter would mean that the over and above everybody killed in the explosions, the fires and smoke would create a cloud that would block the sun's rays, leading to the collapse of agriculture and the end of the human race. Right, so that's have that potential. The Chinese have developed what they call a deterrent force. Instead of having thousands of nuclear weapons, and the U.S. has about 7,000, the Chinese have probably about 300.
Which is enough to completely destroy, the United States, right? And I always wondered why didn't the Soviet Union adopt that strategy when, as you say, you know, as many people have said, it was the expenditures on the military and the nuclear weapons and stuff that ultimately went a huge way towards bankrupting the Soviet Union. But and there was this the Chinese model, and China was not getting invaded, and they only had a few hundred nuclear weapons. Why do you think the Soviet Union insisted that they needed to have as many tens of thousands as the U.S. had?
Well, I think a couple of reasons. I mean, one, they had their own military-industrial complex. Another was their perception of being a great power and not wanting the image of being weaker than the United States, and wanting to be able to escalate at the same level as the United States at every level of escalation. But what's interesting, and where I was going with this, is the U.S. is building up its forces. Putting intermediate-range nuclear weapons near the Chinese coast. The Chinese are increasingly worried that the U.S. will have the ability to wipe out their 200 to 300 nuclear weapons, making them totally vulnerable to U.S. threats. So there's increasing discussion in China about increasing the size of their nuclear arsenal simply so that they don't become totally vulnerable to U.S. attacks. Of course, then the other thing that's at play, making everything much more complicated, is the technological advances, right? I mean, AI technology, cyber technology that could conceivably let somebody hijack a nuclear missile. Yeah. So it's a dangerous situation, and you know, to the degree that we remain anything like a democracy, even if we weren't a democracy. We have the obligation really to work for human survival.
Joe, when I first went to the Hiroshima Nagasaki conference around atomic weapons in 2007, I had a wonderful time, and
I remember seeing you there and seeing you sing there.
Yeah, it was really a wonderful occasion. But one of the things that struck me about the conference, with all these different countries having different representatives there, was like in some of the cases with some of the more authoritarian regimes that sent representatives to the conference, I thought like the main reason these folks are against are here at this conference against nuclear weapons is because they don't have one yet. I mean, you know, at least maybe I'm a little cynical, you know, in some cases, but is that I wonder. I mean, I'm not necessarily asking you to comment on that, but what was your unless you want to, but I'm curious about your history of Japan, when you first went to Japan, because one of the things, I mean, having known you in the U.S. context on the peace movement is sort of it's a whole different thing to be in Japan and see what happens when Joe Gerson comes into a room full of anti-nuclear activists. You are a minor celebrity in Japan, particularly among the anti-nuclear activists, which is no small number of people in Japan. I mean, as they say in Japan, everybody is a worker in May and everybody's a peace activist in August.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah, so, you know, I never really expected to go to Japan. I did grow up with some Japanese art, which I loved. But in 1983, Senator Kennedy here in Massachusetts got suckered in by Ronald Reagan and his administration. And a similar thing happened with Dianne Feinstein in California. As they were preparing to escalate the arms race, their idea was to take old battleships, World War II battleships, out of mothballs and arm them with sea-launched cruise missiles that could carry nuclear weapons. And the idea was to base them in Boston Harbor, or San Francisco Harbor, or maybe New York. There were also in the South, like in Mississippi and maybe Virginia, they were looking to do it. And if we looked at what was going to be based here in Boston, our thought was this was primarily to reinforce U.S. hegemony in the Middle East and to take the possibility of nuclear war closer to the Kola Peninsula, in the north of the Soviet Union. But I was aware of the Navy's history of nuclear weapons accidents, how these weapons violated the freeze, the nuclear weapons freeze that Kennedy had supported. And so with a couple of friends, we launched opposition to what we call the home porting. They're going to put these nuclear weapons opposite a runway in Boston. So a plane.
What could go wrong?
Yeah, any number of things could go wrong. An LNG explosion, and we both through. I mean, at every level we resisted. We held demonstrations, but we brought in city planners in terms of alternate economic development. We brought up the former the officer, basically the operations officer for the Third Fleet, Navy's Third Fleet. Who testified in the city council about the Navy's history of nuclear weapons accidents. And to make a long story short, we defeated them here, New York, and in the West, which basically blocked the effort to bring this weapon system out. I mean, it's probably the best thing I've done in my organizing life. And I had a friend here who'd been working closely with the Japanese movement for a long time. And we had here been unaware that these sea-launched cruise missiles were the principal dimension of Reagan's nuclearization in the Asia-Pacific. And he'd been explaining what we were doing. And so I got this remarkable and ridiculous invitation, all expenses paid, to come to the World Conference Against the A&H Bomb to give a five-minute speech. I was smart enough to understand that it wasn't about me. That the reason I was being invited was to provide a symbol and inspiration for people in the Japanese movement that, you know, that popular movements can actually prevail. And so when I was there, on the one hand, yeah, I had done some work with Hibakusha, the A-bomb survivors, before when they were doing speaking tours here in the U.S. But obviously this was an opportunity to go very, very deep into the experience of the A-bombings and the courage of the A-bomb survivors who were calling for a nuclear weapons-free world. And I also learned, really then for the first time, about the centrality of the U.S.-Japan military alliance dictated to the United by the United States in exchange for the United States ending the military occupation of Japan after the war. And I learned people from Japan, but also elsewhere in Asia, were talking about the impacts of the U.S. military bases in their country. I mean, the United States to this day has more than 100 military bases and installations across Japan. Huge air base in Tokyo, the national capital. And no one else was really doing work on Asia-Pacific in the peace movement at that time. And so I decided to dig in. And you know, my way of being, I did a lot of reading in Japanese history, U.S.-Japan relations. Watched every film by Akira Kurosawa, one of the absolutely most brilliant filmmakers of the 20th century. And I learned that they invited me to come back a few times, and I saw that a role that I could play would be providing analysis, doing what I could to organize solidarity, both with the nuclear disarmament movement, but also with the anti-bases movement, and so on. So I've done my best. We've hosted lots of Japanese delegations here, and it's just totally enriched my life and my family's life. It is interesting.
Do you remember like exactly what, I guess it's like there's a lot of people at the conference and there's a lot of media and there's lots of possibilities for how one might get celebritized in such a situation. But how did that exactly happen though? I mean, what were the particular circumstances?
Well, I had the two elements. I mean, clearly the Japanese movement wanted someone to play this kind of role, which was, I have to say, I wasn't fully aware of it. Before that, there was a remarkable man from New Zealand, Gerald O'Brien, who had been a leader of the Labour Party in New Zealand and played a major role kind of based on the anti-nuclear formula in Kobe, Japan, had done a lot of the work to make New Zealand a nuclear weapons-free country. And Gerald was this amazing orator, a great thinker, and he had this remarkable role. And the Japanese have nurtured, kind of leading figures, movement figures from different countries. I mean, at this stage, one of my friends and colleagues and comrades in this regard is a woman named Cora Fabros from the Philippines, who's just done really great work assisting the Japanese movement, as well as other peace and anti-militarist movements and democracy movements, in her case, in Asia and the Pacific. So to answer your question, I had this remarkable, the first time you fly to Japan, it's a very long flight, especially if you're coming from the East Coast. Mm-hmm. And I'm not really good at sleeping anyhow. And so sleeping on the plane didn't happen. And you get off, getting off the plane lands, you're totally exhausted, you're zonked. And somebody comes onto the plane before we disembark and asks, is Joseph Gerson on the plane? All right, so I raise my hand. There's a film crew filming me as I walk through the airport. And I'm totally staggered. I don't really know how to behave as before doing this. And I keep walking. Ironically, when I got through it all, and I'm trying to figure out how to get into Tokyo where I have to go, everybody disappeared. I was on my own. I had to figure it out.
Oh, no. Not helpful at all. The film crew could have given you a ride.
So but beyond that, it's like part of it is sort of standing and delivering. So yesterday, I had a request from this Japanese, from Akahata, left-wing newspaper in Japan, both telling me about the negotiation, not the negotiation, but the ratifications of the TPNW coming, and saying, this is the Treaty for Prevention of Nuclear Weapons, as I mentioned earlier, and basically saying, look, we'd really like an article from you between 1,200 and 1,800 words by tomorrow afternoon. I looked at my calendar, and I could make some space this morning, to write it. And I did some work on it yesterday afternoon. And you kind of stand and deliver, you know. It's, you know, at one level, you know, in terms of what motivates us, you know, I'm Jewish. I was born in 1946. And I had the basic lessons from my parents, never again to anyone, never to participate in the crime of silence, which is not to turn your head away from injustice, and that there's an absolute link between intellectual integrity and who lives and who dies and how. And then after the Vietnam War, my wife and I worked in Europe for several years, and I had just the extraordinary privilege of working with people who've been involved in the nonviolent actions against Nazi occupations. I mean, mm-hmm. put their life on the lines to save other people and to help build resistance. And before that, I had been involved in the civil rights movement. People talk about, you know, how hard it is now and would it be under Trump, but to appreciate that African Americans have been living in desperate and oppressive situation for now centuries, and still resisted, found that courage. And so, you know, out of these values, you know, I do my best. I'm certainly not perfect, but I do my best to kind of rise to the moment, and do what I can. And apparently this gets recognized and appreciated in other countries.
Yeah, right. Every now and then, in some strange ways, these impetus, you know, the circumstances of what happens when you be who you are and you show up in different places is always it's fascinating, I think.
There's also just the law of unintended consequences, right? You do what you can. I mean, the other thing, I remember coming back from Europe. I had been organizing in Arizona during the Vietnam War, which was tough.
Military base central.
I was sentenced to jail for 6 months for the crime of handing out leaflets on the sidewalk by a judge named Dick Tracy, who had been an FBI agent at Kent State the year before. So
you can't make that up.
No, you can't. You can't make this up. But when I came back briefly to Arizona to do some graduate work after being in Europe. Everything was just totally dead, and so I started to do some organizing, you know, even putting out leaflets on a tree, right? And I developed what I call my ya-ya theory of social movement, which is that you put your ya-yas out, and it generates energy, and other people will pick up and run with it, and I think that's one of the things that you do with your music, right? Putting it out there, encouraging people, and then letting go. You know, other people will take it because, you know, they have their values and commitments, and you do what you can to be a catalyst.
That's right. And then that's what you do, right? But then it's also, whether, you know, maybe people don't want to admit it, or maybe they don't know, I think one of the things that's kind of a bit of an unusual experience that, you know, you and I both share is this phenomenon of having this sort of like minor celebrity status in another country that's basically random. I mean, I didn't pick it, and you didn't pick Japan, and I didn't pick Denmark, but it just kind of like happened, you know. If that didn't happen, it would have an impact on our psyches. And I know many musicians who don't have any kind of, where that didn't happen for them anywhere. And they just feel kind of like lost and ignored in the United States. And it's just, because it's impossible to tour in this country anymore for most musicians to actually, you know, make it work.
Yeah. So just to say, when I give my speeches in Japan, and sometimes when I write, yeah, I begin with a recognition of just the extraordinary privilege that I've had, right? Mm. And which I don't take for granted. You go back, was a Phil Oakes song there, but for fortune, right? There is a randomness to life, and we do what we can, and there are drawbacks too. I mean, you know, you make some sacrifices. I mean, my family, and this was the first August that I didn't go to Japan, in probably 20 years or more. And you know, that's had impacts on my family. So you know, there are elements, you know, of some degree of sacrifice and family sacrifice. But also, you know, the reality is, you know, maybe I would have done some writing or done something different if this hadn't happened. I mean, there are different ways that, you know, we can manifest our humanity.
Yeah, that's for sure. Joe, in the 10 minutes we got, can you give me some thoughts on the next few weeks? And I mean, I don't know who exactly is behind this campaign to talk about what do we do if there's a coup, and what are the 10-step program on trying to rise to the occasion. Mm-hmm. And it reads very much like stuff George Lakey has written, but it's not being nobody's saying who is the committee to prevent the coup, but it's very interesting stuff. And I actually tried to retweet it and was banned from retweeting it by Twitter, because apparently the word coup is in it. So if you're talking about preventing a coup, then that's the same as plotting a coup, and Twitter doesn't want us talking about it. So, but what are your impressions about what's happening now? And you mentioned the executive order the other day. There's a lot of other stuff going on, dismantling postal machines, all these acting heads unvetted acting heads of departments. And
So I think there's a number of different initiatives. So on the one hand, as you mentioned, George Lakey has been at the center of a thing. It's called Defending the Election, with doing trainings for nonviolent action and preparing for mass public protests. Right. I mean, as we speak, I mean, you've had these massive demonstrations in Thailand, which have been challenging, you know, the corruption of that government and the struggle in Belarus, nonviolent struggle in Belarus. To protect the landslide victory that Democratic forces had there. So, we have models here. There's another initiative called Protect the Results, which is a really quite large coalition of more than 100 organizations nationally. People can just Google Protect the Results and get into their page. They've not committed to have demonstrations, but they've committed to call them if necessary, looking with an initial possible call on November the 4th after the election has been held. And in many communities and cities across the country, people are preparing for possible rallies and demonstrations on the evening, like 5 o'clock on November the 4th, the day after the election. What's been remarkable for me, I've joined several of their conference planning calls. It's a delight for somebody my age to be maybe the oldest guy in the room, to look at all the young people who are doing this organizing, taking the initiative. They too are encouraging trainings. There's a map, so they're an important group. I've been encouraged in the last couple of days. On the one hand, I saw a notice that Trumka, the head of the AFL-CIO, was calling an emergency meeting of unions today to talk about how organized labor might respond to an attempt to steal the election or stage a coup. Mm-hmm. And then last night, I saw that the exact formation, but something like the Western Massachusetts District of the AFL-CIO has called for a general strike if necessary. Mm. My sense has been that, and others, I'm certainly not unique in this, that the best way to protect against a coup is for something like a landslide Biden election, or at least an overwhelming election, which would remove any kind of legitimacy for a coup.
Doesn't seem likely at this point, though. I mean, I don't know. There's all kinds of different polls and all that. So having watched the debate last night, I thought Trump did a much better job than Biden at appealing to white people in the swing states that he's trying to appeal to. I mean, it just seemed like, okay, he's going to win the electoral vote now.
Yeah, I don't know. I was looking at the polls from in The Guardian this morning. And of course, you know, given 2016, you know, we can't completely trust the polls. Mm. But what you saw was that in there, in every swing state except Ohio, Biden continues to run ahead. So you know,
it was a post debate poll.
And I think what you want to say, I mean, I think we need to look at Biden with all his flaws, right? He's not going to deliver us all that we need. But clearly a Biden victory would give us the political space and time to do the organizing that we need to do over the next 4 years, and would prevent the consolidation of a Trump tyranny that would, I think, destroy essentially the last shreds of constitutional democracy that we have. It's interesting, too. I mean, we're a long way from it, but I think there's discussion now about the basically the archaic nature of and really anti-democratic nature of a number of aspects of the Constitution. And, you know, hopefully we can build on that. There's another thought. Let me see if I can pull it here. The other piece is that, there's the whole piece about if they're contested electoral delegations and an effort to, for Republican states to basically assign electors who will vote regardless of the popular vote in their state. And there was an interesting analysis done, I think Robert Reich did it, in which he was saying that, were it to take place today, the Republicans control in the House of Representatives, where this would be done. At the moment, Republicans have more votes than Democrats. It's one vote per state. But he noted that in several states that basically the members of the House of Representatives get sworn in on January the 3rd, which means that there could be a more Democratic states in the House on January the 3rd than on January the 20th. So there's a possibility it could go there. I mean, I think what we have to recognize is this is a very uncertain moment, and we have to do in the moment and prepare for the future what we can in order to defend what remains of democracy here, which is only but so much, and to prepare to build back.
Yeah, very good thoughts to end with. Thanks so much, Joseph, for joining me for the hour. It's been really interesting, I think, for other people as well.
Okay. And David, just to thank you for all that you're doing. And just to celebrate our collaboration since 2005, as I recall.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That was a darn good year.
Okay, be well.
You too, Joe. Take care. And thanks, everybody, for tuning in to this discussion with Joseph Gerson, author of the wonderful book from 2008, Empire and the Bomb, which I happen to have right here. Empire and the Bomb, How the U.S. Uses Nuclear Weapons to Dominate the World, prefaced by Walden Bellow, who was often speaking at a lot of events that both of us were around for around 20 years ago. And you can find this broadcast archived on my YouTube channel in the Discussions with David playlist, and you'll also find it in podcast form if you look for This Week with David Rovics on any podcasting platform. I'll be talking having another conversation with Paula DeAngelis on Sunday at 4 p.m. Pacific time, talking more about the work of the Song News Network. And then next week, a bunch of different events, including a Kevin Zeese birthday event online on the 28th that you can find out about on my Facebook page and other places. And also on the 31st, next Saturday, I'll be doing a concert at 1 p.m. here on the internet, 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern. All right. And have a good weekend, everybody out there. And remember, don't pay the rent. Mutual aid will get us through. Trust your neighbors. And I'll talk to you soon. Till then, bye for now.